I'm Jason Klom, and this is Comedy on Vinyl. Start it off, and then we'll talk about it. The year is 19, question mark. It's not entirely clear. The album is Zagan or Zigan and Schumacher. The artist, same, Zagan or Zigan and Schumacher. My guests are the Holy Brothers, Willie Aaron and Marvin Etzioni. Thank you guys for being here.
Thank you.
Hey there, Jason.
Great to be here.
So this is an unusual episode. I have heard the record. That's not unusual. Sometimes it is, but it's not that unusual. What is unusual is I understood about 0.05% of the Yiddish, and that is me extracting from what I know of German. So I understood none of what I just heard today. This is an entirely Yiddish record. So I want to give everybody a heads up. There's going to be a lot of explaining, and that's going to be the fun for me. But I also want you guys to tell people what you're here to promote. Tell them a little about your music, and then we'll get into the record.
Well, I was just going to say that the record that you just talked about isn't our album, but mm-hmm. it's a comedy album sent you by a group that it's a comedy duo who's like the Yiddish Abbott Costello.
Right.
And they were called Zegan and Schumacher. And I believe they were from Poland. And my grandfather gave me the a 10-inch record of them. And a very rememberable track off the record was Einstein Weinstein, that talks about joking about the theory of relativity. Mm-hmm. And so he probably got that 10-inch record originally in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the background. But of the comedy record that we sent you for fun, and more than happy to talk about it. And then Willie and I are in a duo called the Holy Brothers. And we have an album that we are officially re-releasing for during the Passover time in April. And the album is called My Name is Sparkle. And we also have a standalone single and video called Lift You Up that was directed by an award-winning director in Atlanta. His name is Frederick for Tomorrow Pictures. So those are the two things that we're in the middle of.
Awesome. Yeah, I wanted to make sure so that people know what to look out for before we dig heavily into this. So let's start separately. Marvin, why don't you tell me, you just told me where you think your dad probably got the record, but tell me a bit about first hearing it and about how much Yiddish you were raised with.
Well, it was my grandfather, not my dad.
Oh, yes, your grandfather.
I don't remember my parents speaking Yiddish. I grew up next door to my grandparents. When I was born in Brooklyn, we all lived in a house together, and we moved to Los Angeles from Brooklyn to LA when I was about 4. And then we lived next door to each other. And so my grandfather was a record collector, and he loved, most of his records were country records. Johnny Cash, Lynn Anderson, Liz Anderson, Buck, Merle Haggard, Patsy Cline, Teresa Brewer, Merle Haggard. He loved it all. Dean Martin had a country album called Dean Tex Martin. He had that one. He also loved polkas, which were kind of similar in rhythm to a lot of the country records that he liked. But he did have a couple of comedy records, but they were only in Yiddish.
Mm-hmm.
And so once in a while, we would sit down and listen to Zagan and Schumacher. And even though I didn't speak Yiddish, I could understand it just from them. They kind of spoke a broken English, a little bit of English, a little bit of Yiddish, a little bit of the, you know, it was kind of Yiddish is kind of a borscht, melting pot language. Wherever you are, you throw this in, you throw that in, and that became Yiddish.
Right.
Yeah.
How about you, Willie? How did you discover this album?
Well, it's funny because, you know, Marvin and I have very similar backgrounds. My parents were Holocaust survivors. My dad was from Poland and my mom was from Lithuania. And they lived in Germany. They met in a DP camp in Prague right after the war in 1945. Then they married in 1946 and lived in Germany until 1949 when they came to LA with my mom's parents, who were also survivors. So, you know, I'm an LA native, born and raised. And the first language that I actually spoke was Yiddish before I even spoke English.
Uh-huh.
I think for the first maybe 3 or 4 years of my life, I remember distinctly, you know, my parents speaking mostly Yiddish to me.
You know, I was just going to say, Willie, I don't know if you know this, but when I was about 3, my mom and my grandma took me on a trip to Israel.
Wow.
And I don't remember this, but I was speaking Hebrew.
Wow.
By the time I came back to Brooklyn, I was speaking Hebrew to the kids, and all the kids were going up to my mom, go, what is he talking about? You know, they didn't understand it. And then I got back, and then, of course, you know, I got back and it completely left me.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Crazy. So my parents were not, they were musical insofar as they were both good singers. My dad was, you know, play many different instruments. He fiddled on piano and harmonica, and he could pretty much pick up anything and make a noise out of it, which I guess I inherited. They weren't like, it wasn't like Marvin's grandfather. Like, we didn't have a lot of records in the house. But one of the records that we had was this very same Ziggy and Schumacher record. So I remember listening to it with my dad, and he'd start telling me when I was a kid about this hilarious comedy duo called Ziggy and Schumacher. And they were, you know, again, just like very similar to what Martin was saying, that they were like the Yiddish Abbott and Costello. And when I was younger, I not only spoke Yiddish, but I understood it pretty fluently. And recently I bought the record from Discogs, a French copy of it, Ziggy et Schumacher. And I put on that famous skit that Marvin was talking about, Einstein, Weinstein. And I could only make out maybe 25% of it.
Okay.
So the humor that was really palpable for me as a kid, hearing that record, you know, I had to like, I got the vinyl of it. So like, I had to like listen to it a few times, you know, and start it over again to make sure that I got all the, you know, all of the things that were spoken, all the speech patterns, the Yiddish of it. So yeah, it was just one of those things where I think when you're a kid, you are much more apt, like Marvin said, when you're a kid, that's like the best time in a person's life to learn a language.
For sure.
Because the brain is, you know, the most malleable and adaptable to absorb language. But I kind of lament that, you know, both my parents are gone, and there's really nobody that speaks Yiddish in my family. I have one older brother, and he can really only understand it and not really speak it at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of the end of the line. Once my grandparents were gone, that's it. You know, occasionally you hear a word, you hear a phrase, but you know, the thing about Sagan and Schumacher, from my perspective, had they been an English speaking duo, right, and they were here, I mean, they would have been huge in America. I mean, they were absolutely brilliant, and they had that classic duality that many comedy duos had. Lewis and Martin had that. You had the handsome guy, and Lewis called himself the monkey. You know what I mean? It was like you had the singer, and Abbott Costello had that. One guy was really the straight man, handsome straight man. The other guy was going, who's on first? You know,
yeah, kind of the fool.
Yeah, there was like the bright guy, the handsome guy, and the fool. And that balance is what Sagan and Schumacher had. One guy was really smart, really smart. And the other guy a little bit dull. So they're talking about Einstein. Have you ever heard Einstein? He goes, who's Einstein? The guy, the theory of relativity. I don't know. He goes, I'll give you an example. If you have one hair on your head, it's not a lot. But if you have one hair in a glass of milk, it's a lot. That's the theory of relativity. So you understand the other guy says, no. And then the guy gets very frustrated. He's yelling. And then they give him another example. And that's the whole bit. It just keeps going.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really classic, you know, the balance between these two characters that they had. And it always stayed with me ever since I was a kid. And it just came up recently. And I actually made I have my grandfather's copy of the record, and that's when I brought it to a friend's, and he transferred it to digital, and that's how we got it to you.
I appreciate that, by the way.
Of course. Yeah.
You know, and I wanted to listen because I'm like, what's going to be the most familiar thing to me? Am I going to be able to pick out, you know, any Yiddish or any other root languages? And obviously barely nothing. However, characters are very clear. Dynamics are very clear. Timing is very clear. There's so much there where it's clear. You wouldn't have to know the language to know this is a comedy duo doing comedy.
Correct.
And it's there's something brilliant hearing it that way. I'll never fully understand it, but I love it.
It's really amazing about language. It's a real power, believability. I remember, younger on, like, you know, high school, out of high school, huge influences for me were any French artists. So I was into Aznavour, Piaf, Brel, and then later on I got into Gainsbourg. So I love these artists. I don't speak French, but the records can nearly make me cry. I mean, they were just so beautiful. Why did I believe them? There's something about when someone is speaking in their own language, but there's a believability. I'm going to guess that there are probably some people who listen to English-speaking records that believe it, but don't necessarily understand every single word that they're hearing because of a language barrier. And perhaps that's what I experienced, what you just experienced too, as a kid listening to this. I didn't get it all, but it sure sounded funny. Mm-hmm. It just sounded funny.
That's always everybody's experience, though. Every time I bring, even if you understand the language, if you don't yet understand comedic word placement, comedic timing, anything, set a punchline, if you don't understand that, generally your guide number one is, did mom and dad just laugh? That's usually the guide. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, I'm supposed to laugh here. And then eventually you put the patterns together and you're like, oh, that's what funny is. You know, and so it's not that far off. Everybody's first comedy experience is, even if it's not this, different language, is definitely a different world. The idea of comedy, you know, takes a little bit getting used to, I think.
Well, comedy on a cinematic level really started with Chaplin and Keaton, where there was no language.
Mm-hmm.
So they could make people laugh just by sheer images.
Sure.
You know, it wasn't until Chaplin did City Lights and then, you know, Great Dictator, Modern Times, where there was talking, the stories were much more evolved. Modern Times might be considered the first modern film because it was a tragic comedy combined, you know. And so once you had that, the timing was everything. You know, there's a scene, I believe it's in City Lights, and he's in love with the blind girl. And he apparently had shut down his film set for days and days on end to figure out he wants to show up and impress her.
Mm-hmm.
How can he do that? The only way to do that is by him being in a car. Because if she heard the car door, she was blind but not deaf. If she heard the car door, that means he has a car and he's walking out of the car. So he walks out of the car door, slams it, and the blind girl's really nice to him, thinking that this must be a man of means if he's walking out of a car trying to buy some flowers from her. But the timing of that, right? If you look at the timing of comedy films, it's literally split-second timing in terms of editing, whether it's Chaplin or the Keaton movies especially, some people like Lewis and Martin. The Louis De Niro film is comedic in its timing. King of Comedy.
Sure.
So many great comedy films were not just skits, but it's really down to a split second timing in terms of editing, in terms of pacing, and then it transferred into the world of television. It went from film to television. So then you had The Honeymooners in the 50s. And Gleason was a real pioneer in terms of he was not offered the director slot to do his own TV show. CBS said, no, we're going to get a professional. He goes, I'm walking. It's my show. I direct it. I know what I want to do. And he didn't like to rehearse.
Mm-hmm.
And so that point of view has carried on with other folks as well. So he would let them rehearse before his show, but a lot of times he didn't show up because it was live television. Then they would be pissed off at him when he showed up for the live taping, but that's what he wanted. He wanted that tension, right? So when you hear about comedians not wanting rehearsals, this isn't a commentary on the person, but in terms of his art, Woody Allen talks about not wanting to rehearse before doing comedic scenes. He wanted it to just happen because he felt the timing would happen. He didn't like rehearsing.
Sure. But,
you know, as a musician, Bob Dylan doesn't like rehearsing. You know, it seems like a lot of recordings are spontaneously done, a lot of first takes, a lot of early takes. I'm not saying every film was done that way by Woody Allen or every record by Dylan, but timing in comedy, songwriting, filmmaking, record making, you're talking about a second, a millisecond, can really, it's a breath of time that can make you cry or laugh.
And this is a very, there's a lot of speed to this.
Yes.
Undeniably.
For sure.
Willie, how young were you then when you first heard this? I'm sorry, you may have already said that. I apologize.
No, no, you didn't ask that. I was probably, let's see here. I was probably 7 or 8.
Okay.
You know, I got kind of like into that world pretty quickly, you know. Just the other thing, sorry, I'm going to go back to this. The other artist I can remember hearing just tangentially was the Barry Sisters.
Okay.
Who were these Jewish sisters. I think they were European, might have been survivors or refugees or whatever, but they were also very popular in my household. They sang harmony, these women, young women. And they sang like Bamir Bistashane and stuff like that. There was, you know, and
that was the Andrews sisters, right?
Yeah, right. But they did it, you know, and it was in a way more believable because they were Jewish and they sang it in Yiddish, you know, which is what it was originally written. And if you guys watched the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, the first season, I think the first or second episode ends with a Barry Sisters song, and it completely knocked me on my ass because I had not heard the Barry Sisters since I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And my dad used to, on the rare occasion that he would buy music on Fairfax, there was a record store in the 50s and 60s. It was called Nordy's. And it later became like Hatikva Music, you know? That's where, I don't know if this is another side thing. We could do a whole episode on this, but you know who the songwriter P.F. Sloan and Steve Barry, you know who they were?
Not really. I am terrible with music. I'm the worst person to ask.
P.F. Sloan, his real name was Philip Gary Schlein, a Jewish kid from New York who came, like Marvin, came to L.A. when he was young, went to Fairfax High School like Marvin and I did. There was another kid named Steve Barry. And Steve Barry worked at this record store, and they wrote "Secret Agent Man."
Ah, yeah, that was a good. That was that might have been his first hit.
It was his first hit, and then he also wrote "Eve of Destruction" a year later, which is huge too. But anyways, back to this Zygmunt Schumacher thing. I did a little bit of research, and I found out something interesting about them. They were, you know, as we know, they were huge Yiddish stars. And later, when Palestine became the state of Israel, they went to Israel and performed. But when during the early days of Israel's infancy as a state, they really actively discouraged Yiddish from being spoken. Their thing was, we are Hebrew. We are Hebrew speakers. This is our native tongue. This is our biblical tongue. We are, you know, we want as little to do with the old country as possible. It's like a progressive stance and a socialist kind of like young nationalistic stance to take, that we're not going to be encouraging any Yiddish to be spoken. So Zygmunt and Schumacher, of course, are the kings of Yiddish comedy. Then they're so popular in Israel that there was a bit of tension in the beginning when they first started performing there, because the Israeli government said you're not to be doing your act in Yiddish, you are required to do it in Hebrew. So being the smart guys that they were, they said, well, here's what we're going to do. They did their act in Yiddish, but they brought a singer that they liked at the end of their act, and she sang in Hebrew. So that kind of like fulfilled their requirement. But the crazy thing is this, is that they were so popular in Israel, they sold out all the, you know, all the venues that they played, and the actors who were on the bills with them were so honored to be on sharing the stage with Zigmund and Schumacher. The Israeli actors actually learned Yiddish. So they wanted to, that's how badly they wanted to accommodate Zigmund and Schumacher. It's like the opposite of the original intent took place. The Israeli government wanted them to perform in Hebrew. And when they refused, they were like, we're going to do our thing in Yiddish. We're going to come up with this little workaround to have, a Hebrew singer, an Israeli singer singing in Hebrew on our show. And the actors that performed the other skits on the show were so in awe of Zigmund Schumacher that they instead abandoned Hebrew for the show and they learned Yiddish. So Zigmund Schumacher, like, that's just how much influence and how much impact they had on Israel on Israeli entertainment in those early days.
I mean, first of all, Yiddish is a language that I don't imagine is ever going to leave the English language in terms of its impact. I mean, it's there, especially if comedy's still alive. Yiddish is always going to be there in some small bit, at least, you know, we're always going to have it.
Right. And the other thing is that Yiddish is now pretty much the exclusive province of the Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
So it, both in Israel and in the States, in Israel, the ultra Orthodox, the ones that are still around from the old days, they speak Yiddish, and the young ones all over the world, it's almost like that's what the Haredi, which are the ultra Orthodox, that's the language they speak. They speak Yiddish pretty exclusively. Yeah. So that's how Yiddish is kind of like
my family. It's gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my mom, I have cousins in Israel, no Yiddish. I mean, they might know a word or two, but it's not like my grandparents or Willie's, you know, parents, where that was their first and or second language. Like I said, the way it was spoken, Zegan and Schumacher spoke Yiddish, but the way that my understanding, like with my grandparents, it was really, like I said, a borscht language. It was the language of the ghetto, you know? So it incorporated a lot of German, incorporated a little bit of Russian, because you never knew if the Russians were going to come into Poland at any minute. Right. We got to understand them. It had some Russian, Polish, German, English, Hebrew, you know, whatever it is. Whatever they were speaking, they put it all in one batch. By the time they gained, you know, it happened in America, it continued, and then it became Yiddish, a little bit of German, English, and then soon, you know, people, you know, from other countries were speaking English, even though they carried the original ghetto language, really. It was a language for people to communicate freely amongst themselves. It wasn't the official language of any country in the world.
Sure.
English is the official language of America, even though legally, you know, there's nothing in the Constitution that if tomorrow the whole country said, okay, we're going to start speaking Spanish officially,
yeah,
it could happen. But we're English dominated. There's no country in the world, including Israel, that had Yiddish as a language. It's a very, very unique language in that way. It was a language of self-preservation, unique unto the people who spoke it.
These guys are fascinating. There's not enough out there that I could find, with the little bit of time that I ended up having to research. But they started their own cabaret group in Warsaw in 1935. They escaped to Bialystok and performed in a bunch of Russian provinces, tried to get back into Poland, but then were arrested, and they were in camps for 2 years or so, performing in the camps. And then they were together for another 12 years or so before they broke up. But they're two guys who already, that's enough of a story where I need to know everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I need to know everything about these guys. What kind of perspective did you have on these records being in your households? I'd like to hear from you both. Just talk about where do you think it was picked up? Why do you think it was picked up? How often was it listened to? That kind of stuff.
In my case, I would say, my parents have been in America since 1949. Mm-hmm. So everything that they had taught me, the overriding message that they had taught me was, it's great to be American, but let's not lose sight of like where you came from.
Sure.
More so like historically than religiously. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously, I was raised in a pretty strongly Jewish household, but more the religious part came from my grandparents who lived across the street from me. My dad was all survivors. My mom, dad, mom's parents, my dad's parents all perished in the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. My dad survived Auschwitz. The overriding message was, we have to maintain this just as far as my dad didn't give a crap about religion. He was agnostic at best.
Sure.
And he tended to like thumb his nose on organized religion. Mm-hmm. Yet he was intensely devoutly Jewish. So listening to Jewish music, Yiddish music, Zygmunt Schumacher, the comedy, the whole thing he used to say to me was, Jews are really good at comedy because that's how we historically dealt with oppression. It's how we typically deal with tragedy, is to turn it on its head and to make it into something humorous. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't think I think that's pretty much irrefutably true. Just sort of like, if you look at the whole history of Jewish comedy, that's just that through line is throughout the whole narrative. So, I think my dad would pull that record out maybe once a year. Once a year. It was like a thing not to be, it wasn't like a thing that he'd play often and get sick of it. Mm-hmm. It was like a thing to be savored. It's like he'd sit down on the living, on the couch in the living room and put the record on. It was like an event. And he would say, Velvel, Velvel, that's my Yiddish name. He'd say, Velvel, come here, Zygmunt Schumacher, we have to listen. So like he made a whole kind of like event out of it.
I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It wasn't like a routine thing. Like other music, the other stuff that you could listen to. Like my parents were not of the rock and roll generation. Sure. At all. My dad was born in 1919 and my mom was born in 1922. So they were in their 40s when I came along, and which would have been the early 60s. I was born in 1963. So like the music that I heard as a little kid was, they didn't like rock and roll. They didn't like Elvis in the 50s. They thought, I would say, like, what about Sinatra? They go, my dad thought Sinatra was a hoodlum, was a criminal, like a mafia guy. So that was already like made him morally suspect. And my dad liked Tony Bennett more than Sinatra anyways. He thought he was a better singer than Sinatra.
All right.
But the Barry Sisters and all the other like, Jewish music that we'd hear around the house, that we could hear with regularity. But Zygmunt Schumacher, for some reason, that was like an event. It wasn't anything that like, it wasn't a routine thing. He reserved time, special time to listen to that on like pretty much a once a year.
But the other thing about Zygmunt and Schumacher, there was nothing else like them. Mm-hmm. There was no American equivalent, and I didn't know of any other Yiddish comedy records. Like, that was the only ones I knew. He had a couple few of them, but that was the bit that I remembered, growing up. But I think that instilled a sense of comedy, because later on I was into Jackie Mason had an album. His first album was called I'm the Greatest Comedian in the World, but nobody knows it yet. So I just love the title of that cover. Years ago, I went to Canner's, and it was like 1 a.m, and I ran into Jackie Mason.
Whoa.
And I told him, I said, when I was a kid, he was with a couple friends. I said, I hope you don't mind me interrupting, but I want to let you know, I have your first album, I'm the Greatest Comedian in the World, but nobody knows it yet. And he looked at his friends and go, whoa, I haven't thought about that in a long time. It wasn't like some big hit record.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, he actually signed. I said, would you sign this from my mom, like a little card or something?
Yeah, yeah.
Very nice, you know.
Love it.
You know, so, other comedy records might have been Cosby to Russell with My Brother with Whom I Slept.
Sure.
Wonderfulness. I mean, certainly, you know, nobody knew in the decades to come what someone like Cosby would become. But in terms of his, you know, he was like the Elvis of comedy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was like the Black Elvis. It was just like there was nobody bigger than Cosby as a kid. And the records are great. So it kind of instilled, and it wasn't something conscious. And I think that would, I connect to what Willie was talking about. It was kind of a special thing. Okay, we're going to listen to Sagan and Schumacher. Come on, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, my grandfather called me Marvola. Marvola, come in. We're going to listen. You know, and it would just be him and I. He knew that I liked listening to records with him, you know. And so we just have a special moment together about it. But it was one of the few comedy records that he actually had, because mm-hmm. I never saw any other Yiddish comedy records. And he didn't understand English enough to get an American comedy record, one spoken in English.
Fair.
That would have been too quick for him.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of English speaking comedians, he would love watching Marx Brothers. That was something we really connected on.
Come on.
Because they had, there was something, you know, it was a lot of slapstick.
Mm-hmm.
And even if it was highbrow and quick, it was just something viscerally funny about them and their timing.
Sure.
Whether you got all the jokes or not. I had heard that Margaret Dumont, the sidekick for Groucho Marx, apparently she never understood what Groucho was talking about, you know, and that's what made it funny. Her expressions were real. Like, what are you saying to me? She didn't get it, you know? So if you watch the films with that light, you know, you realize that it's actually funnier, but it's the same dynamic, you know, kind of the fool and the smart ass, you know, the smart guy, you know, trying to pull one over the other person. So she had that foil with Dumont, with Groucho. So comedy was really important. And then if you go into music, a film like Hard Day's Night, you know, mm-hmm. the Beatles were known as, you know, the British Marx Brothers with Hard Day's Night. It was four guys that were playing off of each other that had a real comic sensibility. And
strong personalities too.
And sure. Exactly. Yeah. And in fact, tonight after this, there's a Zoom between Eric Idle and Sacha Baron Cohen. And
And
I remember some years ago, I had the honor of actually a bunch of people went out to dinner and a friend of mine invited me. And there was an artist I was working with and he was performing one of my songs. And, you know, we all, prior to the show, we went out to dinner and Eric Idle was sitting right across from me. My friend knew that what had happened was Eric Idle said to me, he goes, did you work with a band called Toad the Wet Sprocket? And I said, yes. And he told me the story.
Oh my God, of course.
That Eric Idle said he was driving down the street and then all of a sudden on the radio said, and that was the new single by Toad the Wet Sprocket. He said he almost pulled over and got into an accident. Like he couldn't believe that someone took their gag and turned it into a pop band. Not that it was going to make it on the radio. And so we had a great time. He was very, very nice. And then after the show, he came up to me and he said, did you write that song at the end of that? I said, yes, I did. He goes, wow, that was really great. And I haven't seen him since, but he was very nice about, you know, wanting to keep in touch and you know, it's all a continuation, you know, just like in all of the arts, it's like this mm-hmm. thread that just keeps going and going,
yeah.
you know, and certainly Idle is one of the masters, you know.
Of course.
I got a funny story about the Jewish comedy too.
Please.
That's a great one though, Marv. I didn't know that one.
Yeah.
My wife and I, when we were living in Santa Monica, we had just gotten this dog, and we lived a couple blocks away from the beach. We'd walk the dog, and one day we're walking the dog on Ocean Avenue in Santa Monica, and we see this very distinguished looking man in an ascot walking his little dog. And the dog's like, you know, is your dog friendly? Yeah, they start, our dogs start playing. We start talking. And he's a British Jewish guy named Stephen Maitland Lewis. He was a lawyer and a writer. He's written some novels. And he says, you are a delightful couple, and I would love to have you join me for brunch at the Friars Club. And now this was back when the Friars Club, was still around.
Sure.
And so we met him at the Friars Club in Beverly Hills on a Sunday, and it's like a huge spread, and we're sitting at a table, and who should come over but Buddy Hackett.
Oh, my God.
Buddy Hackett comes and sits with us, and he goes, hey, you see that guy over there? That's Jan Murray. Jan Murray's wife just died, so if he comes over, laugh at his shitty jokes.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
And, you know, the thing about that is those guys, that's over. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you think about all of those kind of like, you know, Borscht Belt comedians, it was such a huge part of, I mean, Marvin and I connect on so many levels. And I mean, and by the way, the fact that we connected, you know, not just on all the other musical stuff, but that we're the only two people that we know, the only two that know who Diggin and that had a similar experience with Diggin and Schumacher, because there ain't nobody
who
knows who
correct.
The hell they are. Nobody. So that's like another, it's just our whole meeting, our whole relationship over over 40 years has just been completely serendipitous on so many levels. But I just wanted to say that, you know, like the whole comedy thing, being Jewish in LA, you know, in New York too, obviously, but like, you know, Marvin had mentioned Cantor's. One day we were in, I finished doing a gig up at the Sunset Strip at the Roxy. And I'd come to Cantor's, you know, hanging out with a bunch of friends of mine in the middle of the night. And who walks in? Rodney Dangerfield with his, you know, with his wife and kids. The entire back of Cantor's stood up and applauded. Like, as soon as he walked, he was like, oh, it's okay. You know, like, he did this thing.
You know, time I went to a movie one time. I was going out, and there was nobody in line for this movie. And Rodney Dangerfield was, like, right next to me. He's getting a ticket. Wow. He was just really, I don't know, it was kind of like, it was the opposite of that of Willie's experience. This is like the lonely Dangerfield, you know, he's like a trench coat. You know, he's like, hey, nice to meet you. Yeah, nice to meet you. You know, it's
like, great. You gotta tell the Larry David story, Marvin.
And also I know Willie, you've got a time frame. So you know, just make sure you're okay. So Larry, I'll be honest with you. I didn't know anything about Larry David, right? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until this is true. It wasn't until day my friend Gray Delisle, an artist that I produce, is on
friend of the show. She's been on this show before,
right? So
she's awesome.
Records, she's great,
wonderful.
Calls me up one day. He said, "You got to come over." I said, "Okay," and she plays me this TV show. I said, and she goes, what do you think? I go, it's okay. He's a funny guy. He says, no. I mean, that guy's like you. It's like, I said, and then like literally the next week I'm hanging out with my son. He goes, hey dad, you ever hear about this guy, Larry David? You ever hear about him? He goes, and then, so we're watching him. He goes, what do you think? Well, I mean, you get it? I said, what is everybody talking about? You know? And so anyway, years later, going to a movie at the Arclight, which is on Sunset Boulevard, and one of the nicest theaters in Hollywood. Really great big screen, really, you know, and the really crowded evening. And we're having dinner, and as we're leaving, I look over and I see Larry David. He's having dinner with someone. And I'm thinking, I got to say hello. So I said, excuse me, Larry David. I just wanted to say how much I like your show. And he goes, that's okay. What's your name? And I said, my name is Marvin. He goes, Marvin. He looks at me and goes, it's like he's trying to find, like he's holding a pin. And he looks at you like you're a balloon. Mm-hmm. All right? And he's just going to find that spot to pop you. with his, you know, and he looks at me and goes, and I'm wearing these glasses. And he goes, how are those glasses working out for you, Marvin? I go, really, really good, Larry. No, no, come on, man. Really? Those glasses? Really? You're not embarrassed to walk around with glasses like that? I said, Larry, the girls love them. What can I tell you? So this goes on for like 5 minutes back and forth. Like all of a sudden, now I'm on his show, right? And so he's drawing, doodling. You know, I noticed he was drawing on the piece of paper on the table. I said, Larry, did you draw that? He goes, yes, I did. And I said, Larry, I didn't know that you could not draw. And so we're going back and forth. We're talking about music. And he was really nice, you know, and very funny. I said, Larry, I got to ask you one thing before I go. He goes, do you mind? He goes, no, go ahead. But what did you want to ask? I said, let me ask you something. Larry, are you Jewish? I made Larry David laugh. Okay. That isn't the chapter of, you know, of a book, I don't know what is. Yeah. I made Larry David laugh, and I was very happy about that.
Yeah. Marvin called me afterwards. He goes, Willie, I just met Larry David. And he insulted me. It was great.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's the dream.
Yeah, it was really, I really felt like, gee, I want to do that next week on his show, too. That would be great. I could be the guy living next door. I'm working on some songs. What are you working on? It doesn't sound too good, but what? Are you going to get some glasses? What?
Yeah. I love it. It's so good.
Yeah.
This is out of left field, but it occurs to me because it's an episode that I've been working on potentially of this show. I used to do this segment or a mini series on the show called Family Albums, where I'd interview the people, basically sons and daughters of people who have since passed and have made great records in the past. The one you picked today is not the first entirely Yiddish record I have considered doing. There was a guy named Menashe Skolnick who did Yiddish music, exclusively Yiddish. Mm. And his vocal character is not unlike, my brain has just fried, Mickey Katz. Like
sort of. I knew you were going to say that.
Mickey
Hold
Katz
on a
is
second.
The other Yiddish.
Hold on a second.
Yes, please.
I knew you were going to say that.
I mean, who else?
That's awesome. That's hilarious. There's a jazz musician in New York named Don Byron, an African-American jazz musician, who was a huge fan of Mickey Cass's too.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, you know, like, I think funny is funny. I just think that's just like, it's pretty much, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's another one. Check this out.
Yes, there we go.
Wait, where's Marvin?
Mishmash.
Can you see this?
Hold on.
Hovers of every one of his records are insane.
Right?
Hold on, I gotta. Hold on. I just lost you guys.
Uh-oh.
Hold on here. Oh, wait, let me see.
You see that, Willie?
No, hold on. Oh, yeah, there we go. Yep.
Mishmash. You know what mishmash means, Jason?
I mean, I have a general idea. You should define it for me.
Yeah, mishmash. It's a big mix-up.
Yeah.
It's that's a mishmash. Sure. It's all crazy. Right. You know, it's like it sounds the way that it is.
Mm-hmm. I didn't want to get it wrong.
Yeah.
I knew better.
But I remember the song as a kid. Myself. This was one from my grandfather's collection.
Yeah.
This is probably, Willie, you could probably confirm it, but check this out. Capital. Look at this Capital label. Right.
Let's see. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So this was the original 50s.
Very
yeah,
nice.
It definitely is.
Right.
Definitely is.
So it has a song called Pacha Me, Pacha You, Pacha Me, Pacha You. Everything goes Meshige, Pach, Pach, Pacha. So, you know, what that means, I don't speak it, but I remember it. So it's like, hit me, you hit me, I'll hit you, I hit you, you hit me, and everything goes crazy.
Right.
It's not funny in English. It just doesn't translate. It's just not funny. But you hear it in Yiddish, but to hear people like, you know, my grandfather or, you know, Willie's father to say that, to say Yiddish word. You hear the word schmaltz from my grandfather. You could feel the grease coming out of the pan and dripping onto the stove. You know, it just didn't mean like, oh, it's a little messy. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So, and two things. One, I also wanted to point out, we were talking coincidentally, I got to put my reading glasses on. I think it's on this record, or maybe it's not. I might have another one as well, but I have another one by him, but it was one of the Marx Brothers who wrote the liner notes.
Oh, wow. Love it.
Yeah. You know, so I think it might have been Chico, right, who wrote the line. I might have another one of Mickey Katz. But you know who Mickey Katz's son was?
Yeah, we were just talking about it. I've been trying to get Joel Gray on this podcast for a very long time.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay, well, I might be able to help with that.
Oh, my goodness. Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding.
Holy shit. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. In fact, I'll call a friend. I can't give any other details except...
Of course.
I'm going to make a call for you.
Except your friend was in Ferris Bueller's Day Off. You can't say any more.
No. Not the case. No.
I'm going to have to
By accident,
off in a minute, but
yes. I got sent an email, and it had his email address, but I never wrote to him. Yes.
Yes. I'm at this. Before we sign up, can I leave you with a joke?
Yes, of course, please.
Okay. So, okay, we're all talking about comedy and stuff. My father, hands down, guy that survived Auschwitz, hands down, the funniest person I've ever encountered in my life. Mm-hmm. Okay, by far the funniest person, inadvertently. So two things. One thing I remember that he did was. I remember when I was living at home, when I was a teenager in high school, I used to like to study at the kitchen table. And Jason, are you from LA originally?
No, New York, okay. Upstate New York.
Okay.
Well, what city? You know,
a little town called Oneonta.
I know about Oneonta. Huh. Don't the Yankees have a farm team there? Mm-hmm. I'm a big baseball fan.
Oh, okay.
So my dad used to go to Cantor's Deli in L.A. He used to buy dry salamis. Mm-hmm. He would take a dry salami, and just for a laugh, while I'd be studying, he would take a string, measure the string. So that it fit when he put it on him, he would put it around him so that it fit, so the salami would land right in front of his crotch and walk around the house. Oh, all right, and on that note, I'm going to have to say my goodbyes.
I was feeling pretty good until right then.
Sorry.
Now, I'll tell you something. Not only do I know that story is true, but Willie told that story at his father's service, so you know he's not. You know he's not making it up.
What I always ask at the end of an episode is, give me in a couple sentences why give this album a listen. It's a hard recommend if people don't speak Yiddish, but you know what? I'm giving you the hardest task of the day.
You know, if I always find it a challenge to listen to something that I wouldn't normally listen to, whether it's in another language, on a song level. I used to like that as a kid. You know, it's like Chris Rock is one of my favorite comedians, you know, and so I just love it all, you know, and I'm open to just, I think if you just keep an open mind, maybe you'll feel something that you didn't experience prior to listening to Sagan and Schumacher, you know, and in this day and age, it's comic archaeology.
Yeah.
Right? Because
absolutely.
you're discovering something that nobody is going to know about except for you.
Yeah.
If you listen to Sagan and Schumacher and you hear Einstein Weinstein, and maybe you get it, maybe you don't get it, but at least you'll be exposed to it. But you realize that it's part of a 60, 70 year heritage of comedy, where comedy has taken us today. If those guys were around today, they would be on Saturday Night Live, you know? So it's all intertwined. Yeah. You know, it's all intertwined. So it's like Mickey Katz, the Marx Brothers, Joel Grey, and you keep going on into, you know, Lewis and Martin, and then, you know, sure. All of a sudden you're decades in, and it's all connected to where we are right now in comedy, good, bad, or indifferent, yeah. You know? So yeah. I think that if someone, I have a sense of curiosity that if I haven't heard something, it's like, yeah, I'll at least listen to it.
Sure, yeah.
You know, so that's, I think that you got nothing to lose. No one's going to get hurt. And yeah. it might sound so out there to you that you might just laugh by just being exposed to it. You know, mm-hmm. It's like sometimes I put on sitcoms in Spanish mm-hmm. because I don't understand them. But I just think they're so funny because you can tell that they're overacting at certain moments and they stop. And, you know, that's the funny bit. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you know, you could just tell that no matter what language, we all have two ends. We all look at each other in a particular way mm-hmm. and certain things happen in certain times. So I personally like that kind of stuff.
I love that. No, that's a really, that's a very good argument for it. And it's going to, and you're going to help me with the argument when we down the line have to do again, some okay. other entirely Yiddish record. I know it's going to happen at some point. Someone's going to pick right. one.
Okay.
So tell people again, where they can find the band, where they can find you guys online, where they can find your record.
Absolutely. So, last year in 2020 during lockdown, I signed a digital distribution deal with Six Degrees Records for my label's regional records. Mm-hmm. And so far we've put out my solo album, which is called What's the Mood of the Country Now. My Name is Sparkle is being re-released in March, full album. And then the Holy Brothers have a standalone single called Lift You Up. And we got Stefan Ferguson as the voice of Dr. Martin Luther King on the recording.
Wow.
I have a standalone single called Love Letter to Democracy. And then Gray Delisle is also on the label. Gray Delisle has a single out called Valentine mm-hmm. for her album Borrowed that's coming out later this year. And then she's also working on an all-originals album.
Awesome.
And so... we're looking at other records as well for 2021 and 2022. But, you know, every day there's so much going on, and we're real excited to have support like folks like yourself. And all the records are available, and the singles are available on your favorite digital platform. And, you know, because when we started to talk last year, all the record stores shut down. So sure. I said, well, why don't we just go all digital right now? We'll see what happens later this year. You know, mm-hmm. could be another year till things get normal. It could be longer. You know, there are more international strains coming in. So, you know, I like to keep things positive, to be around people who are positive and want to get things done on a day-to-day level. And that's really all I'm trying to do, is bring as much music and put as much energy into songs and as I possibly can. And that's my way of trying to make the world a little bit better place.
There's nothing wrong with that. Come on. That's a good thing. Please, everybody check out their music. The website again for, what's the website
could go to
label.
regionalrecords.com. You can also, The Holy Brothers, T-H-E-E, Holy Brothers. You can go to any digital platform and find the album and the single, and same thing with Gray Delisle, her single Valentine. And stay in touch, and you know, there's more to come.
Wonderful. Thank you again very much for doing the show.
My pleasure.
I'll tell everybody else just to go to stolendress.com. That's where all my other podcasts are. Obviously this one is there as well. And thank you all for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. You can email us at podcast@comedyonvinyl.com. You can also send snail mail to Stolen Dress Entertainment, P.O. Box 805, Burbank, California, 91503. Subscribe to Comedy on Vinyl on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Give us a 5-star rating and write us a review. It helps. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Comedy on Vinyl, or find everything in one place at comedyonvinyl.com. A major portion of Comedy on Vinyl has been underwritten by Stand Up Records. Please visit standuprecords.com for all your comedy needs and tune in to the new Stand Up Records channel available on the Roku, where you can also find select episodes of this podcast. Visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, watch videos, and imbibe freely of our multimedia content going back 15 plus years. Undress Entertainment.
Hey, it's my turn. Ah!